as friendly if you need to.
So that would be terrific, because I will get the
musicians. Have them all put in one big frame. They can be in there.
That would be excellent. That sounds like an awful lot. Well, we might say, I imagine people will come in, but there's nothing particularly happy to say in the introduction on that.
No.
But I will mention this, because I think this is terrific timing. Well, welcome to today's Vital Issues seminar. It's terrific to see you here. As parliamentary library lecturer. Ian's just corrected me. Richard, what? He has to have a good cup of tea and a lie down. Ian is our speaker today. Richard is our organiser. We developed a series called Parliamentary Library Lectures last year because there were a number of issues where it was really valuable to have someone to come and give a deeper presentation rather than the offering that we've been providing through our Vital Issues seminar, when we have two people speak, often from opposing points of view on an issue. One of the issues that we sat down when we were discussing our planning late last year for this year's program was really what are the issues in terms of regional universities, in education, in growing regional communities, which is the theme of Ian's speech today. We've had a number of changes to the higher education system, and while it's perhaps not as talked about now as it has been in the last 15 years as an issue, the whole shape of our education system is incredibly important, particularly when we look at things like the Intergenerational Report that actually says that Australia's labour market is going to be profoundly challenged in the next 20 years because it is the universities that have a really important role in growing our future skills and in fact in relating to the development of those industries. So it was. I've been very fortunate to have seen Ian every couple of months for the last year or so because we're on a committee together, the Unilink committee, that provides support to a number of universities. And he's really committed to the broad visions of cooperation of higher education and regional communities. And so it's just wonderful to have you with us today. I won't go over your biography because it's in the handout that everyone has, but welcome. And there's a great announcement in today's higher education supplement as well about the university and its development. So I'd encourage you to read that after you've heard Ian today. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roxanne. Good. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen to this lecture today. I know you've got a very busy agenda on at the moment, a particularly exciting time in the political cycle, so I'm very aware of the time pressures on all of you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you at today's Parliamentary Library Lecture. And Roxanne mentioned the word regional. I'm going to talk about inland, and I'm going to make a distinction in regional between inland and coastal. And the example I use, quite frankly, is Wagga Wagga is qualitatively and quantitatively different from Coffs Harbour. One is a coastal regional town, Wagga Wagga is an inland regional town, and they are different. They are roughly the same size, that's not perfect, I could have picked another coastal town. But there is a difference between inland and coastal, and I will speak to the inland message and what that means in inland Australia, the particular challenges, but also the opportunities that sit within those challenges for inland Australia. In that context, I suppose I'm going to talk to you today, share with you some of the aspirations of inland Australia, as we see them at Charles Sturt University, and the aspects of Charles Sturt University's current and potential role in achieving the aspirations of inland Australia. Because in inland Australia, and I'm going to talk about that rather than regional, partnership is a key issue. Partnership with local communities, partnership with governments at the state and federal level is a key to achieving success for inland Australia. If you look at the higher education supplement today, you'll see the headline Charles Sturt to rebrand inland. We've come to that realisation in the last couple of years, and we've sought to position ourselves strongly as the National University of Inland Australia. Pretty bold, pretty brave stuff, but very clear about where we sit in the higher education sector and what contributions we make to higher education and to our communities. The National University of Inland Australia. Very bold, very brave, but it clearly says where we are, what we do, and the national word I'll come back to because it means nationally and internationally accredited and recognised education rather than regional education. And that's very, very important for vibrant inland communities. The approach we're taking as being the University of Inland Australia actually resonates with our namesake Charles Sturt, an Australian explorer, core innovator, whose 19th century expedition inland to determine why the Murrumbidgee and Murray rivers flowed west is regarded as one of the greatest explorations in our history. Notice that going inland to explore, the essence of Charles Sturt University. Clearly Charles Sturt was a problem solver. The very fact he did that is a problem solver. Where does Charles Sturt University take a similar approach? Consideration of intractable problems and preparing professionals to take on these challenges in our communities is the essence of the university's mission. And you'll notice already, I'm unashamedly about Inland Australia, and I'm unashamedly about Charles Sturt University. I cannot separate those in my mind in terms of what we're doing. My lecture today will focus on themes in a policy paper distributed last week by the university that explores a series of issues. It's called Growing Our Communities Through Education and Research. And I encourage you to get a copy of this through the university if you want to. Growing Our Communities Through Education and Research, something that Roxanne referred to in terms of what universities do. That document identifies some of the university's priorities for areas of growth of Australia's inland communities. I could rephrase that, priorities for Australia's inland communities and what Charles Sturt University could do for those communities. The document is not a set of demands or a list of woes. It's really an exploration of issues. And that's an important issue. Often when you hear the word regional, there's a tone of disadvantage in that. We don't believe regional should be a disadvantage. We believe it should be a powerful message, a self-sustaining message for inland communities, regional communities. So it is not a list of woes. It's a set of challenges to make inland communities more vibrant and dynamic than they currently are. And the document also explores a means to get hold of the opportunities for tackling the challenges we face in inland Australia. And there are challenges in there, we know that. And the challenges I'm going to list for them, they're not exclusive, but they're key to a successful, vibrant inland Australia. And therein I would claim a sustainable, successful Australia. Inland Australia has a role to play in Australia's success. The first one is maintaining and improving both the health and well-being of inland Australians and the clinical practice education experience for students who want to be part of the health workforce of inland Australia. So improving health and well-being, and I'll come to that, how we might do that as a university, how universities might do it, and how to get better professionals in inland Australia and the special challenges that sit there. The second one is growing the agricultural sector while sustaining our environment. A very timely question given the re-emergence of the drought we hear in the media, but also the importance of agriculture to our economy, and particularly to inland economies. The third one I want to talk about is continuity of supply and retention of qualified professionals. And the fourth one, equitable access to local, nationally and internationally recognised education opportunities, including on-campus accommodation. Notice that? If it's going to be done in Wagga Wagga, for example, it's got to be good enough to get you a job in Santiago, Rome or Tokyo, but you may choose, a lot of them do, to work in Coonabarabran. That's what we're talking about. I'd like to address those points one by one, and I welcome the questions at the end of my presentation on any part of those things. The first one, improving the health and well-being of inland Australians, something that goes to the heart of what we are as Australians at the moment. It's not news to anybody here today that people in rural areas of Australia have poorer health than their metropolitan counterparts. And we can spend a long time listing those things, be it in medical health, be it mental health, be it dental health, and you know Charles Sturt has been very successful in dental health, addressing those problems. In particular, this relates to inland Australia, the health status of Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders is unacceptable. Again, very timely, and you're well aware of that. Flying from this imbalance in health outcomes, and it is an imbalance in health outcomes, derived from a maldistribution, which I'll come back to, of health professionals. But from this imbalance in health outcomes and other contributing factors, because there are other factors I acknowledge, the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare Health Report in 2006 found that there were 3,300 additional deaths annually in rural and remote communities above what would have been expected for the same population groups in major cities. That's a documented thing. Higher death rates out there. Even you pro rata them, 3,300 more deaths in rural and remote communities, call them inland communities generally. Implementing workable strategies to increase the number of health professionals practicing in inland and rural locations without oversupplying metropolitan locations or centres will be a critical priority for both Commonwealth and state governments for the next 2 decades. Meeting the demand in inland Australia while not oversupplying metropolitan centres. It's a challenge and we'll propose some solutions to that. While there has been a strong commitment by government to address shortages in the supply of doctors, dentists, oral health therapists, hygienists and nurses in inland communities, we acknowledge steps have been taken. We believe Australia needs a comprehensive strategy to address the geographical maldistribution across the range of allied health occupations. So you don't just do a bit here, a bit there, but a comprehensive strategy. That requires planning and integration, and it's a challenge. The provision of health education and training in inland and rural areas is critical to sustaining and growing our rural health workforce, and has been proven to significantly increase the probability that graduates will remain to practice in inland and rural communities. The training in inland communities is a significant determinant in the willingness to practice in inland communities. Notice the willingness to practice. I'll come back to that point a little bit later. A report by the Western Research Institute on graduate destinations found that more than 70% of Charles Sturt University's on-campus graduates from health disciplines who were originally from regional areas, and over 20% of on-campus graduates from metropolitan areas took their first job in a regional area. There's the retention numbers we talk about extensively. This evidence would appear to support the conclusion that it's necessary to educate health professions in inland and rural Australia to address the maldistribution and corresponding shortage of allied health professionals. And I'm using the whole suite of health professionals in that definition. There's also support for the view that rurally based education and training may be more cost effective. So we've got how we get people to choose to work in inland Australia. What about the cost effectiveness? After an extensive review of the health workforce by the Productivity Commission in 2005 was concluded, and I quote, provision of education and training in rural and remote areas may still be a more cost-effective way of improving access to health workers than, for example, seeking to entice less willing qualified practitioners away from the major population centres through the use of financial incentives. The commission, further on, the report says, the commission supports a strong focus on the provision of regionally based health workforce education and training. So it's a cost effectiveness issue there coming out of the Productivity Commission. Excuse me. In a preliminary report by the Australian Medical Students Association, it was reported that 25% of medical students were considering buying their way out of their 6 years rural service obligation. That was in the Adelaide Advertiser. So here's the willingness versus the bonded. And I'm upfront about that. What's the way to get people wishing to work in inland Australia rather than requiring them to work in inland Australia? While studies have shown that rural outreach programs such as short experience placements and rural health services have a positive effect on student perceptions of rural communities, there's been no definitive study to establish their effectiveness in actual retention of graduates in rural practice. It does improve perceptions. That goes to the sense of regional communities being disadvantaged, that disadvantaged tone to many of the ways we talk about regional Australia. Charles Sturt University, and I'll come back to the university here, is committed to growing and developing our professional health programs to address the effects of maldistribution on the supply of health professionals. We do so through the provision of education programs totally delivered in inland communities, featuring innovations characteristic of inland Australia, the innovation, that exploration, dealing with intractable problems. This approach significantly enhances the recruitment and ongoing retention of graduate professionals in inland Australia. And I've given you those figures before in terms of the health workforce. I'll give you some examples in other parts of the workforce. But coming back to the innovations of inland Australia, a term that we've now come to understand, we did it before we understood it, and it's a key to inland workforces or rural and remote workforces, particularly health. Interprofessional training is one of the hallmarks of Charles Sturt University's approach to addressing the rural health workforce shortage. Interprofessional skills are particularly critical in rural locations where the shortage of trained health professionals requires practitioners to have a broader understanding of health practice beyond their particular discipline. You don't have buildings full of speech pathologists and buildings full of physiotherapists. You have isolated, often fractional appointments. And the capacity to work interprofessionally is being driven by the needs in inland Australia. And I'd argue that need will occur in metropolitan Australia in due course. So we're doing innovations and pioneering work there. And I would say, in fact, I would assert that the requirements for health professionals working in inland locations are higher than those for similar professionals working in metropolitan locations, because of the existing requirement for interprofessional practice and being able to do that effectively. That's to give out integrated health services in inland communities. Reflecting our success in returning health professionals to practice in inland Australia, earlier this year Charles Sturt University was successful in obtaining funding for the construction and equipping of a new dental and oral health program to address the chronic shortage of dentists and oral health professionals across inland Australia. A really good initiative. And I'll come back to the strength of that and how it serves as a model for things we'd like governments to look at in the future. We take, as a university, take a strong evidence-based view that educating students in inland areas significantly increases the probability of them going on to practice in inland and rural communities. And I'll give you some figures on that, but we go through those figures endlessly to see that we are continuing to retain those graduates. Therefore, we believe, and this is a call to governments, I suppose, that consideration should be given to the following. One, provision of support for the development of regionally based integrated health workforce plans that link population trends, practitioner intention and demand, where they want to go and where the demand is, and provide a robust framework for point-in-time planning and funding of health education programs and inland and rural universities. To tall ask, it requires state and federal government participation. Regionally based integrated health workforce plans, a challenging thing. I said in my earlier in my, my talk, it is challenging, but we shouldn't shy away from it because it's the heart of what we need to do for inland Australia. Secondly, a review of existing funding programs designed to encourage metropolitan graduates to locate to rural practice to determine the cost effectiveness of those programs and their capacity to meet the long-term needs of inland and rural communities. That's the willingness versus required aspect of it. Let's have a good look at it. We've got data that says, suggests certain things, but we're not afraid to look at a really good program and say, how cost effective are they? And are there other options? Thirdly, establishment of university departments of rural health at rural based institutions in areas not presently covered by these departments. There's a challenge there to a range of universities and health, health providers to support clinical exposure and retention of clinical practitioners. So not just having university departments of rural health focused in a couple of areas, but broadly across the whole of the allied health program education. And fourthly, that funding for rural health education programs be directed to the development and expansion of health disciplines located and delivered in inland and rural institutions in identified areas of need. I'm unashamed about inland Australia, you'll see that message coming through. Now I'm going to come back to an aspect of that training. Clinical practice education, which is part of the training of health practitioners, provides students with real experience in clinical decision making prior to them going out to work as independent professionals. Unlike medical graduates, the majority of health professionals are expected to be ready for professional clinical practice upon graduation. That's a very important point. It applies to dentists, it applies to podiatrists and physiotherapists. The clinical practice is there essential to them being effective and competent practitioners at the point of graduation. They need to be confident and competent in assessment, clinical decision making, care planning and evaluation. This is critical to safe, quality patient care. And this is the message we hear consistently with relation to health. Intensive clinical practice experience is also a requirement for the registration of nursing and allied health clinicians in Australia. The level of exposure to clinical practice during undergraduate and postgraduate education ranges across the, varies across the professions, with up to 1,000 hours typically required for nursing and allied health professionals. We at Charles Sturt University have a particular focus on professional education. Our mission says education for the professions, quite simply that, and the preparation of employment-ready graduates across all our programs. Clinical practice education is essential to our university's teaching learning philosophy and is embedded in its strategy, right up front in the core strategy. However, the cost of clinical practice education for universities is significant, including the cost of clinical coordinators to organise placements, academic supervision, travel to placement locations and accommodation, negotiation of contracts, insurance coverage, and placement fees payable to some providers. Nursing and allied health students are required to fund all or part of their attendance on clinical placement, including travel, accommodation, often supplementary to maintaining accommodation near the university campus, and I'll come back to that with the special aspects of rural universities, and loss of income. It's estimated to cost each rural student an average of $1,500. These costs reflect the way that rural and inland students typically have to live away from home to study, travel longer distances and face increasing accommodation and associated costs, for example, broadband connection to access clinical placements. We have programs to enable metropolitan students, to assist metropolitan students to take placements in rural locations. We don't have comparable programs to assist rural students who might have to travel twice as far to assist them in their clinical placements. To meet the demand for additional clinical education placements, many universities have established primary healthcare clinics as part of their professional preparation programs to provide clinical exposure for students. This is an important aspect. It's not just about clinical training. It goes some way to dealing with the lack of health services. In inland areas in particular, these clinics have the added advantage of providing reduced cost health services to inland communities in areas of critical shortage. They can provide health services. So not just for training, they can provide health services in needed areas. And have the capacity using telehealth technology to act as a base for extending services to more remote locations. Not just in that location where the clinics are, but to more remote locations, which we face in Western New South Wales, the key part of our inland Australia. Charles Sturt University has already established small specialised clinical simulation laboratories across its campuses to provide students with access to realistic environments in which to practice and be assessed on their clinical skills. We established a podiatry clinic and a diabetic and cardiovascular screening clinic in Albury-Wodonga. Interestingly, cardiovascular disease and diabetes are two of the leading causes of death in inland Australia. Now, clinics are delivering that service while also providing the opportunity for clinical training for our students. We also have a functional rehabilitation clinic in Bathurst for those who are mobility impaired, be they young, be they old. And in Australian first, and this is recognised it was in the last budget, the university was awarded funding from the Commonwealth Government to construct and equip 5 dental education clinics across inland New South Wales to meet the clinical experience requirements of students enrolled in its new dental science and oral health programs. These clinics not only provide students with a high quality clinical environment, they'll also provide for members of our communities unable to access public services or afford private dental services. So it's a training facility, but it also goes part way to meeting the unmet demand, shall I say, the long waiting list for dental services. So you see the clinics as a training facility and a way of meeting medical services coming together. Inland Australia needs a sustainable framework to ensure the continuous supply of nursing and allied health professionals to meet the needs of an ageing population and to provide the more cost-effective care options into the future. The clinics can be part of that. With a significant number of health students being educated outside metropolitan areas, our university believes that consideration should be given to the construction of a state-of-the-art Centre for Interprofessional Clinical Simulation Training in inland Australia. What does this mean? That's got computer simulation of clinical practice, lifelike mannequins for our students to practice on before they practice on real patients, so they've got higher levels of competency before they get to real patients, and telehealth. When I say high-level mannequins, they're frighteningly real. They exhibit signs and symptoms of illness and injury in most graphic ways. I'll leave that alone at that point in time. But to date, these laboratories have been located in metropolitan centres. There's a need for one in inland Australia because the different type of practice, the interprofessional practice, and inland Australia where the training is being done is a key to retention. As I'm saying there, such a centre would not only help to prepare students for professional practice, but would also support, and this is very important, continuing professional education and development and interprofessional learning for existing practitioners. It might also help address the common concern of rural practitioners across the board about lack of access to training and development opportunities. One of the complaints we hear about existing practitioners is their opportunity for professional development. And this will go partway to it, this clinical simulation training centre is a way of addressing it. What is challenging? We recognise this. The establishment of such a centre would require changes to accreditation practices and recognition of formal competencies attained through clinical simulation. Accreditation practices tend to go to the old ways, if I call it that, requiring patients for all of that training. I think there's room to move in that with the simulation laboratories and with real practice on patients, but a more balanced approach to that. It would also require the support of area health services in rural areas. Once again, it's a partnership with our rural area health services. The recurrent cost of operating the centre as a training facility might be met in part through the provision of continuing professional development courses for the health professionals in both rural and metropolitan centres on a fee-for-service basis. So there's a coming together of practice for clinical practice. We have trouble accessing those places. Assisting the existing professionals maintain their professional development. Those things come together. We therefore believe that the government, state and federal, should give consideration to the following. One, examination of funding models for the expansion of university-operated primary healthcare clinics. University-operated primary healthcare clinics in inland and rural locations to perform the dual role of increasing public health services in critical areas of shortage and expanding clinical placement opportunities. The dental clinics are an example of that. Training opportunities and meeting the demand for dental services. Two, examination of the options for extending Medicare. And here we get into some debatable area. But for extending Medicare or providing fee-for-service payments for the full range of primary healthcare services offered by existing and future university health clinics in inland and rural areas. For example, dentistry, physiotherapy, podiatry, speech pathology, psychology, you can run through the list. Such a program would expand existing public rural health services, extend services, provide incentives for rural universities to develop health services associated with their academic programs, and provide a reduced cost service to inland and rural communities under the Medicare benefit scheme or another special service program. It's a challenge. We think it needs to be on the table for consideration by governments. Exploration with the health insurance industry of options for extending insurance rebates to clinical services provided by students under the supervision of a lower under supervision on a lower cost per service basis. Part of the operation of these clinics will be students practicing and learning under supervision of qualified practitioners. At the moment, the health insurance industry is not able to deal with that. We believe we need to talk to them as a way of addressing those issues. Fourthly, examination of options for extending university primary healthcare services and clinical education to outer regional and remote communities through the expansion of telehealth care facilities. This might also include support for the establishment of mobile clinical education units that can transport students in training, supervisors and equipment to remote communities to deliver health services and provide students with clinical experience. Again, the training and the health services intermission. Five, to review the funding cluster for nursing and allied health to ensure that it appropriately reflects the true cost of preclinical and clinical education. It is expensive. We can't shy away from that. And examine, finally, the establishment of a rural clinical placement support fund to provide direct out-of-pocket financial support to rural students to attend clinical practice programs, not just those who might be introduced to it from metropolitan areas, because there are big distances out there, and we would go a long way to Broken Hill from Dubbo, for example, to provide those services. The second issue, I'll leave health alone for a few moments, is growing the agricultural sector. You'll be aware that agriculture is a critical part of Australia's economy, even in this time of drought. Representing 3% of gross domestic product and about 22% of Australia's merchandise exports, it's still a big item. As other sectors of the economy has grown, it can no longer be said that Australia rides on the sheep's back. We agree. However, there is a continuing importance of agriculture to Australia's economic health and prosperity that is often understated, and I would add often misunderstood. In employment terms, and this is where I come back unashamedly to inland Australia, agriculture is central to the sustainability of inland and rural communities. Someone said, it may not be the agriculture we know today, but agriculture will be out there in the future. Around 17% of those employed in inland and rural Australia are directly engaged in agricultural production. 17%. This year it's estimated that more than 670,000 Australians were employed or dependent on someone employed in agriculture, forestry or fishing industries. These are significant numbers in terms of economic contributions but also employment contributions. There are also significant opportunities that we should be well positioned in Australia to take advantage of. There are about 6.5 billion people in the world today. This is estimated to climb to 9.3 billion by 2050. The World Health Organization estimates that population growth, that's growth in heads, and here's the important part, improved standards of living in the developing world will significantly impact demand for agricultural production, with per capita consumption of livestock products worldwide estimated to rise by 44% by 2030. Increased numbers of people, increased wealth in developing countries, more increase in consumption of meat. And we know the inputs into meat are grain. And poultry consumption predicted to grow even higher than the 44% in that same period of time. If negotiations to reduce global agricultural subsidies are successful, we know the challenge is there. However, agricultural trade worldwide is estimated to increase by about Australian dollars, $330 million by 2020. This will occur at a time of reduced availability of land for food production due to land being diverted to energy production or removed from production due to environmental concerns or going into housing around cities. There's great opportunities there. We're challenged by the way in which land has been utilised. The growing demand for food worldwide is a major opportunity for Australia's agricultural sectors and our national balance of trade and our inland communities, yes. But it's an opportunity. But to do that opportunity, we need to be ensure that our education and training is up to the mark. The Department of Education, Science and Training have figures that show that Charles Sturt University is at the forefront of universities in Australia with substantial domestic undergraduate enrolments for agriculture. And this may surprise you. In horticulture and viticulture, we're very proud of that viticulture, and the flower and effects of wine science, I might add, Charles Sturt University commands 19% of national enrolments and 64% of national distance education enrolments in horticulture and viticulture. So we see our role quite clearly in being an agricultural university, and it's absolutely consistent with being the University of Inland Australia. We've recently consolidated our considerable expertise in agriculture around two main areas of plant science and plant science management, animal science and animal management, a veterinary science program approved by the federal government a few years ago as part of that. These two new schools, plant and animals, I call meat and veggies, but that's not treated particularly well in the university. The schools will work collaboratively to expand agricultural education and research for the benefit of inland Australia. And it's education and research, and I'll come back to the extension factor in a few minutes, because they have to be put together if we're going to get the most bang for our buck in terms of public investment in agriculture. We're confident that our move to focus our efforts in agriculture, and we've gone through that refocusing, restructuring, will help the university focus on its strengths and strategically invest in areas of agriculture that will stimulate future growth and meet future demands. Future growth in agriculture and agricultural enrolments and meet future needs for agricultural professionals as they change into the future as technology moves along with agricultural production. The capacity of Charles Sturt University to undertake this challenging role in terms of maintaining education, research and extension in Australia's inland communities can be seen with broad recognition of all aspects of the problem. Agricultural production and environmental agriculture, I don't use sustainable, but the environmental aspects of agriculture can be seen, and here I'm unashamedly Charles Sturt, in the Australian Museum's 2007 Eureka Prize for Water Research and Innovation, awarded last month to a joint Charles Sturt University and CSIRO team, including Professor Shabazz Khan, Professor of Hydrology in the University School of Environmental Sciences. That's an innovation, Water Research and Innovation, the Eureka Prize. Interestingly, Professor Khan is also head of the UNESCO International Centre of Water for Food Security, currently being established at Charles Sturt University at Wagga Wagga. Water Innovation and Management, head of a Centre of Water for Food Security. You can see the coming together, the convergence of those aspects. That's consistent with our view for inland Australia, environmental sustainability, economic and sustainable agriculture, part of what we do. We believe, and this is important, that integrating agricultural education, research and extension, and I put extension on there very purposely, at designated centres of agricultural excellence and public universities is essential in Australia if agricultural professionals and farmers are to effectively utilise and adapt agricultural science and management techniques to contemporary problems and to embrace new agricultural technology into the future. We are saying farming will change. They have changed a lot of them recently. New technologies will develop quite properly in water management, you can see from the first example. How do we get that out as rapidly as possible? It is wrapped up in the basket of education, research and extension. Extension is technology transfer, but it's often not technology transfer in the way we think of a device going out there. It's something deeper than that in many cases. In a recent report by the Commonwealth House of Representatives Standing Committee on Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, titled Skills, Rural Australia's Need, Inquiry into Rural Skills Training Research, the committee noted, and I quote, evidence received by the committee during the course of its inquiry indicated that there are severe skill shortages in rural industries and significant gaps in our capacity to respond to those shortages. We hear skill shortages in many areas. Often the agricultural skill shortages falls below the radar. They're out there, they need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed in a high quality fashion. The committee, the Commonwealth Committee, also noted the findings of the New South Wales Legislative Council Standing Committee on State Development titled Inquiry into Skill Shortages in Rural and Regional New South Wales in 2006. And I quote from that report, the evidence before the committee clearly shows that there are extensive skill shortages in rural and regional New South Wales across almost all sectors of the economy, including the agricultural sectors. So we need to ensure that agriculture remains vibrant, powerful, up-to-date and well-recognised if we're going to sustain inland communities and the agricultural industries that are so important to them. I might add that in the Albury-Wodonga Wagga region, the agricultural industries constitute about $1.7 billion, 41,000 jobs and about 33% of the gross regional product of those areas. So significant numbers there. Agricultural employers also indicate that agriculture graduates from metropolitan universities are reluctant to accept employment beyond the fringes of metropolitan centres. Coming back to that retention, training in inland areas, propensity to practice in inland areas. As agriculture becomes less attractive to prospective tertiary students, the agricultural programs in some tertiary institutions have become less viable. And the challenge is if you do them in the cities, we're not going to get the people to go out to where their needs are. One of the challenges we think we can take up as an inland university. We believe these figures indicate the need for agricultural education, research and extension to be placed in inland locations, where the training and technology transfer can be more directly and effectively targeted at its agricultural communities. The retention factor of graduates. Never forget the fact that the highest skills transfer, the highest technology transfer in any profession is often the skills of the graduates who enter the workforce. If the research is there and extension is there, the skills of the graduates that go into the workforce is a high level of technology transfer. On the basis of these figures, Charles Sturt University is of the view that consideration should be given by the Council of Australian Governments to a strategic review of agricultural education and research to examine. This is calling for a review. We've put our view forward, we've done it in the speech. But what we think should be examined is specific methods to increase enrolment in agricultural higher education. Part of that is saying agriculture is a great profession. You never hear those words out there. There's a great profession in agriculture. You hear doom and gloom and drought. We've got work to do. Secondly, the most effective means to integrate research, education and extension programs in agricultural production regions. Read Inland Australia, I'm unashamed about that. Challenging one here, the appropriate distribution and number of agricultural education programs within the states. More challenging, more difficult, across the state jurisdictions. The potential for co-location of agricultural and education and research, so agricultural education and research in inland and rural location, as a means to enhance recruitment and retention of graduates in inland and rural locations. The consolidation of public investment in agricultural education and research in rural public universities as a means to reduce duplication, improve cost effectiveness, enhance linkages between education research and extension, and build the international standards of agricultural education and research, and expand the domestic and international market for Australian agricultural programs. Really building the prestige of our programs and reducing duplication. The great examples, I suppose, are the great land-grant universities of the United States, which have that huge extension. That's where the work is done for the states. We believe as a university, of course, we're well positioned to support such an agenda, but we're open to the review, strategic review. We think we're well positioned because of our concentration on education and research programs in areas directly relevant to the agricultural zones in which we operate. Our focus on applied education, that's education for the professions. Applied research and industry collaboration, our partnership model. We partner with the state government in two centres, a wine and grape industry centre and an agricultural innovation centre. Our ability to meet workforce needs through the retention of graduates in inland and rural employment. Many people can do the education, few can do the retention. And our capacity to link disciplines in agriculture and environment, Shabazz Khan, the Eureka Prize winner, being the leading example of that. Agriculture and environment, linking management, information technology, spatial information, marketing, biosecurity, plant and animal sciences. And never forget biosecurity is an issue. We thought about foot and mouth disease, we thought about avian flu. We've seen equine influenza. And our capacity in inland Australia to deal with that is a challenge for us. One of the reasons we have a veterinary science program at Charles Sturt. The other issue I want to talk about is continuity and supply of retention of qualified professionals across the board. I've focused on health and agriculture and underlying things there. The impact of Charles Sturt University's location is marked in terms of our retention of graduates in inland and rural Australia. I'll share some figures with you. In a study last year by the Western Research Institute on the destination of on-campus students after completing their professional studies found that 73% of graduate students from Charles Sturt University who are originally from a regional location took over initial employment in a regional location. 73% of our rural students, roughly, took over their first employment in a regional location. Perhaps more importantly, or as a challenge to many things, 28% of our graduating students with a metropolitan home location took up initial employment in a rural location. So we get the metropolitan students out, we're more likely to retain them than they are to move once educated in metropolitan Australia to inland Australia. So I gave you the health figures before. Overall, our figures are higher at 73% as opposed to 70, and 28% as opposed to 20%. Coming back to agriculture again, the same analysis by the Western Research Institute shows that 88% of our agricultural graduates from rural areas take up their first employment in the regions, and over 40% of our agricultural graduates from metropolitan locations take their first employment in inland Australia. These figures demonstrate the value of public investment in agricultural education targeted to workforce needs in the rural agricultural production sector, targeted to retention. I'll come back to that many times, you'll notice in the speech. As I noted before, those figures are 70% for health graduates from regional locations and 20% from metropolitan locations. We're actually part of the thing of reversing the trend to going into big metropolitan centres. Since 1975, the percentage of regional students initially employed in a regional location has grown at an average rate of 1.3% per annum. So we're actually increasing the rate of employment of our students in regional locations. That's key to retaining professionals. Be they in accounting, be they in IT, be they whatever you want, they're going to be retained if they go through an inland university. I want to use a very interesting example. To demonstrate the significance of this in real terms, between 1995 and 2000, before the first Charles Sturt University graduates in pharmacy, on average three metropolitan trained pharmacists located to regional areas in New South Wales each year. That's three. In our first graduating class, and every year since then, 35 graduates or more have chosen to practice in rural and regional locations. Have chosen to practice, 35, not three. It's not double or triple, it's an order of magnitude difference. That is, in 3 years, over 170 new pharmacists in inland and rural Australia in just 3 years. Without Charles Sturt University, many more towns and communities would not have a local pharmacist, leading to a further decline in professional services across inland Australia. Through our commitment to the operation of distributed campuses across our major inland centres, Dubbo, Orange, Bathurst, Wagga Wagga, Albury Wodonga, locations of Canberra and Goulburn as well, we've significantly increased access to and participation in higher education across our inland communities. That's a strong input factor. Higher participation backed up by higher retention of the graduates in inland Australia. In the last 10 years, to show that we're committed to this, we've opened a new campus in Dubbo and transferred from the University of Sydney and grown a campus at Orange to further enhance local access to higher education opportunities to inland communities. Also, through our extensive distance education programs, adult learners and students from remote communities are able to access high-quality educational services locally. We're growing the inland communities. And interestingly, the Orange campus just transferred from Sydney is characterised by something I've spoken about extensively, health and agriculture. And it makes sense when you look at that community. The final issue I want to take to you is equitable access to local education opportunities. This applies across the board. Charles Sturt University is firm in its belief that people of inland Australia should have the right to access, and I quote, nationally recognised standards of higher education and research in their own backyard. If it's going to be there, you don't make it good enough for regional Australia. We don't want to hear that. It's going to be nationally and internationally recognised. Such standards of education cannot be limited to metropolitan locations, and I'll run off some numbers later about how it challenges our thinking in Australia. Retaining skilled professionals is critical to the provision of essential services and amenity of inland and rural Australia. Vibrant inland Australia will depend on the retention of those skills. The loss of skilled professionals has a domino effect across inland communities and their economies. In critical areas such as health services, it can lead to a systemic loss of professional services and support structures, essential to community sustainability and growth. This is why Charles Sturt University places such importance on the training of professionals who will choose to practice in inland Australia across all our fields of education. Our inland location is also why Charles Sturt University recruits rural students to its on-campus programs. I'm using these figures because they come back as an accommodation issue. 75% of all our on-campus students come from a rural home location. It's been proven time and time again that rural origin, accompanied by education fully delivered in a non-metropolitan location, is the major determining factor in the decision of graduates to commence professional practice in a rural location. They come from rural locations. That is important. Most of our students, the great majority, who study on campus at Charles Sturt University have to leave home to do so. It's not like the cities where you can stay at home and go to university. Even if they come from inland Australia to our campus, they're probably having to move home and pay accommodation costs there. On-campus university-supported student accommodation is important for students from a rural location for this reason. And if they wish to study in a non-metropolitan environment, they wish to have accommodation. And accommodation is important for four reasons. Being able to live on campus is now a deciding factor for many parents and students in their choice of university. You'll see that in the media. And many people are building facilities to increase student accommodation. As I said before, many Charles Sturt University students come from rural and remote locations. Even towns of Griffith, 23,000, still requires you to have accommodation in Wagga if you're going to study at Wagga. They do not have the option of living at home during their studies. Paying normal residential rents during their study increases the financial burden for students and parents and contributes to increased attrition from these students. This is an out-of-pocket expense. HECS is a deferred fee. HECS is a very powerful thing. Accommodation costs are not deferrable. You put your hand in your pocket immediately. On-campus accommodation is also important because students who live on campus, on university-supported accommodation, with all the support we put there, are more than 50% less likely to drop out of university study because the supports are there when they go through the dark times or the difficult personal circumstances. We also know that on-campus university-supported accommodation attracts more students to regional centres, contributing to gross regional product and the diversity of our communities. It's important to students in their decision, it's important to students in their retention, maintaining that we get full value from the public investment in their education. Our university currently has about 2,100 on-campus university-supported beds for students across its campuses. 2,100, less than 40% of student demand, a waiting list of 3,900. Also, due to the age of our accommodation, around 500 beds will have to be closed over the next 5 years, so they'll no longer be serviceable. And we don't have the property and the buildings that we can leverage as metropolitan universities for certain partnerships to build accommodation. It's different out there. We have plenty of land, but you can't leverage that land value as agricultural value to build things. We also know that, you know, repeat year students who live on campus during their study are more likely to complete their course successfully than students who do not. In fact, our leading courses in pharmacy and veterinary science, the students want to spend all their time on campuses, increasing demand on campus accommodation. So our view that consideration should be given to the establishment of a special funding program to support the construction of university-supported on-campus student accommodation at rural-based universities, or make a differentiation there from metropolitan universities, to expand the availability of low-cost accommodation to non-local students to meet identified demand. Such a program would assist, and it is important, in ensuring that parents and students can make fair academic choices about where they want to study without lack of access to accommodation being a deciding factor. If they don't have a bed, people may not be able to come and will choose not to come. Ensuring fairness to students and families from rural and remote areas by providing access to cheaper on-campus university-supported accommodation. We don't say low quality, we say inexpensive. So we're not running as a profit, it needs to be supported in some way. This is a support for rural communities, inland communities. It's important for this review in terms of improving retention and completion rates and therefore reduce wasted investment in uncompleted studies. Uncompleted studies are a wasted investment. Yes, there is some return. It's not the same return as a graduating with a degree. Reduce dropout rates. And also, as I said before, contributing to the gross regional product of regional communities. I've given you today an overview of Charles Sturt University's agenda for Inland Australia, or Inland Australia's challenges and Charles Sturt University's responses to them. It's an ambitious agenda driven by a university with a clear vision of its role in meeting these challenges, the voice of Inland Australia. We want to be that voice. We hear a lot of things about metropolitan Australia, some things about coastal Australia. Often the inland voice is not heard. Put before you a bit of a challenge that relates to higher education as much as anything. This role for Charles Sturt University is a fairly comprehensive role for Inland Australia. As a comprehensive non-metropolitan university, also challenges Australia's culture of metrocentricity and the conventional wisdom that a great university cannot exist outside the capital cities. Conventional wisdom of Australia. It's a very metrocentric society. I'm a citizen of three countries, I've lived in four countries for more than 4 years, and this is the most metrocentric I've lived in. Unlike many other countries, Australia has no tradition of international universities being able to exist outside the major cities. I want to show this is contrary to the facts elsewhere in the world, where significant universities prosper away from larger centres, because that's a bold agenda we've put in front of us. Think Cambridge or Oxford universities in the United Kingdom. Second and 10th respectively in the world, or Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, 12th place in an Ivy League university, a town of 45,000. University of Wisconsin in Madison ranked 16th in the world. And I can list 9 other universities in North America, in towns such as Iowa City, West Lafayette, Bloomington, in the top 100 in the world. Or McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, ranked 90th in the world. They're not in Toronto, they're not in Chicago, they're not in the big cities. Cal Davis is not in Los Angeles or San Francisco. It was interesting that McMaster University, in the top 100 in the world, and Charles Sturt University agreed to offer joint degrees in Canada with McMaster University. They believe good universities can exist outside the capital cities. It challenges the metrocentricity. But Charles Sturt University inland is where we work and where we live. It's the historic heart of our nation's economic prosperity and character. It is the historic heart of where we come from. We talk about the bush, we tend to think coastal. It is the food bowl, the energy source, the primary producer for our nation. Think about where things come from. It is the source of a major part of Australia's gross domestic product and international exports. I spoke about agriculture. but a lot more things come out of inland Australia, the mines and things like that. Inland Australia must therefore be productive and vibrant if Australia as a nation is to develop and prosper sustainably. Inland is the home of great innovation and invention, our remoteness, a variable climate, our participation in a competitive global economy, and the challenge of ensuring access to critical services for smaller populations have driven us since the time of our settlement as Australians. Charles Sturt University is an inheritor and custodian of this tradition. But our university's role is anything but passive. Charles Sturt University is an agent of economic and social development in inland Australia. Our focus is on problem solving and acting as a driver of economic and social development to grow our communities in inland Australia for a vibrant, prosperous and sustainable inland Australia. Thank you very much indeed.
Professor, you mentioned the word mine in about the second last sentence in your conclusion, whereas in no other part of the lecture was any attention to any great deal on this stunning inland industry.
Yeah.
And I just put it to you, is Charles Sturt looking at the possibility of opening any resources? I'm talking mineral resources or petroleum resources, education opportunities, and I could perhaps target Orange as a location which would be appropriate.
We have been approached on that question a number of times. One of the challenges is not so much the demand for graduates from mining industries, but the demand for the courses, and you see that in engineering across the board. We at KU Mines, obviously in Orange, has spoken to us. We are talking to them about training across the board, but not necessarily in mining. I think we would leave to that the significant investment required in mining education without the health service delivery possible through, if I could call the health services area. But we have been approached on that. The challenge for a lot of these technical things, and this is science and engineering at large, is the lack of people wanting to do it. It's not the lack of employment opportunities at the other end. So if you open something and no one comes, you can get into trouble in that respect. We would love to be able to do something more, but it's just a challenge. You talk to other universities, you'll find the same. But there's some fine universities doing work in mining, and we should explain to them about the advantages of working in inland Australia.
Thank you. Yes. I might actually, as someone who was a inland rural student who went to a metro university, in fact worked for several universities, I've always been interested in this, especially seeing my community going back there and kind of seeing the pain of young people that go out of the community. Yeah. It's interesting, we were talking obviously from a higher education perspective, but more specifically looking at agriculture and horticulture, I've always thought that there was a need for that to be addressed in a secondary context, because often it was very rare that our school, where I come from, had a very thriving agricultural and horticultural area. But it may be one of four or five in Victoria. So there's not much in terms of a context in secondary, whereas there is in the higher education sector. And I don't know whether that's something you've perhaps looked at Charles Sturt, but also the secondary part that I was just going to mention is some of the social factors that students, like the fact that you build up relationships and you build a whole employment network and friends and a whole range of contacts, and that's what's happened, I've seen, for a lot of us who have moved to Melbourne.
Yeah.
We have a life there, so it's very hard to move back into rural areas, even though some of us may want to, because you've created a whole social network. So that's where that might be actually the basis for some of the figures you mentioned, because you looked at retention and it shows there are obviously factors there, but if you looked at what's behind some of those factors.
You're right on the money with your second comment. I'll come back to the question about the secondary. We've got a challenge. Agriculture is a science, horticulture is a science, and viticulture is a science. Mm. And it's subject to an even worse view that I think science in schools is at the moment. We are concerned about the number of science people coming through. Secondary do not promote agriculture or horticulture. Agriculture is a top level of viticulture and horticulture in the way we'd like it. Now, part of that because they're seeing their families in some strife, and you hear some story about suicide and things like that in drought affected areas. There needs to be considerable work, and we'd support that. I think with the Commonwealth Review of Agricultural Education, we need to market agriculture as a proper, not just land production, but also the value-adding industries outside the farm gate. as an option for employment. That would require working down at the secondary schools, again saying agriculture is an option, an agribusiness or a science option, and working with the TAFEs. We work very closely with TAFEs across our footprint, as you'd expect. I think we're the fourth or fifth largest intake of students on the basis of TAFE qualifications of any university in Australia. So real work to be done there. That's part of that review, is to see how can we increase enrolment in agriculture, and I'm sure it would push back to secondary education. Because students make their decision not the moment they get their results. They make it a long way back. Now, some come later to the decision to agriculture, but many of them set their minds probably 8, 9 when they start to figure out where they want to go, and it takes a bit to divert them from a path to this spot or that spot there. Mm-hmm. Coming back to your retention figures, you're right on the money. This will sound completely incorrect, but once they find the people who they're going to be partners with for life, or their friends network in those communities, they are retained. If they go to the cities, their friend, their networks are there, and it's hard to get out of them. And often if you get a partner, it's hard for the partner to get a job if you come out to mainland Australia with you. You're both out there to begin with. This is incorrect stuff, but it's the guts of the matter. Both have jobs there, you have a final chance of retaining them. So exactly that. What we are finding that, interestingly, in pharmacy, the students are actually going out and not just working in pharmacies, they're buying them up and starting up new whole health services industries. And we've only been graduating students since 2001. But it's, the ones I hear about is a husband and wife team who are setting up like a huge multi-million dollar business 4 or 5 years out. But it is the networks of friends. Now, for those people, if they've got a friend in Deniliquin and they're working in Albury, that's close enough to say we can meet over the weekends or get together. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to come out of Melbourne or Sydney, which we really work with. To our south is Melbourne, to our east is Sydney. Yeah. But you're right on the money, it is the social networks. There's something on top of that as well. We do, getting experience of living out there as well is important. So not just the networks. If you take the clinical, you've studied in Wagga Wagga, for example, or I say Albury Wodonga for change. You've studied there, you know what the town's like, you've had some fun there, you've got your network of friends. Then you do your clinical placements in a Deniliquin, because I use that example again. So when you get your first job, possibly in Deniliquin or Hay or Griffith, you're not surprised. Because you've already been there before, you've been in Albury Wodonga, it isn't the big shock that you might have if you've come from, shall I use Melbourne to use your example, to Deniliquin. You say, what the hell is this like? Whereas they've been in Albury Wodonga for a while, they've been in Deniliquin, the step isn't as big. And it's not just the recruitment to first employment. I think that clinical practice in regional locations is germane to retention a number of years out. Now retention figures show retention, say 13 years out in some areas, of up to 70% of the first cohort that went into work. So there's something in our curriculum and experience of living in regional communities. And in our curriculum as well, I think we give case studies which part of that interprofessional stuff, so you're not actually surprised that you're working with a bunch of other people out there.
Because it's interesting that we, through the Senate committee system, we see a lot of evidence coming out, but it's all relating back to that central point, is that around agriculture, and especially inland communities, you're getting the perceptions of agriculture being poorly skilled, not well paid, which in some part are true, but that's because they haven't been built up as an industry. It's kind of left to primary producers as family units in some cases, and there's no role there for innovation or technology. And when you haven't got training or a whole range of skills being added in, research, what have you, it actually trends downwards. Whereas what you're trying to achieve, I assume, is to get that to trend upwards.
That's exactly where we're trying to go. And the level of technology might be, for a family farm, might be precision agriculture. I know that sounds strange, but how you put fertiliser in the ground when you're planting wheat, or precision viticulture, and how you, those things are out there right now. Getting the graduates out there who can do it, or the extension services associated with your research, so it gets out there very quickly. I'll be parochial again. Shabazz Khan, that water professor, one of his great characteristics is he's out on the farms all the time. Many of his photos are him with a computer on the edge of a paddock, which is working right there with the farmers about what they're dealing with. So getting that out there is the only way to bend that back up. Because you did right, if you don't bring technology into it, you're going to be uncompetitive, either in price-wise or access to water or all the other things that environment or the new climate change environments are putting on top of you. So you did right, we'd like to bend that back upwards. And that's a challenge for us, because I don't think we're going to... We shouldn't let agriculture just run down. I think that's a negative view. It may be different in the future, and I'm open about that. But there's a great opportunity. If we get it right, given the demand for food production, it can be a huge economic contributor. If you look at those figures, there's more heads in the world, and increased consumption of meat and all the increased inputs to that, there's great opportunities. But it's going to require for us to do things differently. You can't simply do what we're doing right now and be part of that in the future.
I suppose, following on from that point, I think there's two big challenges you've got there. One is that when it actually comes to extension, we've had a couple of decades where the agriculture departments in the states have all, dramatically decreased their extension capability. And I think New South Wales was one of the last holdouts, but that still happened there.
Yeah.
So certainly, we can see that there's this massive need for us to have this technology transfer, particularly with the problems that we're facing with climate change and so on. But we've got that problem in terms of how do we actually employ those people. And we've also got the problem of declining student enrolments. Yeah. And I appreciate what you're saying, that retention when you're out there studying in the rural location is absolutely the way to go. But there's still the problem of how many students you have wanting to come and study agriculture.
Two things in there, going back to the extension one. There's a copy of the speech up if you want to read it, and it's the same words as I said before, roughly, though I added a few bits in there. We are calling for a review to deal with exactly that extension problem, because our view, it doesn't work well. And there's a view that's often aired in the Council of Deans of Agriculture, there's too many agricultural providers. It was aired in the early 90s when I first arrived in Australia. It was too hard, but I think this is going to be tough. We need to have a good look at that. Where agriculture is, who does it, because there's diminishing demand. So if you just keep diluting everybody, you're not going to help anybody. So it's playing to your strengths in that respect. And how you get extension in there, and that may require a major rethink, the bowl, of how the Commonwealth interacts with the states in terms of extension and technology transfer. And we don't have the answers, that's what we're saying. Call for a review, we'll contribute to it. We are confident of our own position, but look, we see what comes out of that review to deal with exactly that issue. Because extension services have been run down, that comes back to that previous question. Farms are on that downward trend as well because they're not getting the changes that are possible out there. Not all can be taken up, not all farms can do it, but I think we can do better than we are right now. Now, your other comment on...
it was actually student enrollment numbers and how many students now see agriculture as a career.
That's a real problem, and the decline is variable. I think it varied from... We went down by about 5%, I think it's a Melbourne report, Western Sydney, by about 10 or 15% declines. We're quite pleased with it's holding up reasonably well, but it's still got a decline.
Yeah.
That just actually points to a number of things. Should there be as many as there are right now? Now, I say that thinking that the review might come in and point back at me, but I think for the sake of Australia, let's have a really good look at it and make some calls. And to some extent, I'm accepting the challenge that universities play to their strengths, and the university will differ in what those strengths are.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm an inland Australian.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the policy issues that I don't think we look at closely enough is why we need an inland Australia, particularly given that we're such a coastal country. And you've intimated that the countries you've lived in, this is the most metro-centric. Given that, particularly in the agricultural sector, that we export 80% of what we produce, and we've got a sort of a first world cost structure, but a second, third world price structure.
Yeah.
Why do we need an inland Australia? Why do we need people there?
If you continue to grow coastal Australia, metropolitan Australia, you're going to end up going to stuff it up, quite frankly. I look at the challenges you hear around Sydney and infrastructure, and if you look at the environmental population pressures on coastal Australia, there is a real argument that a lot of those populations should be in dynamic communities in inland Australia. So if you take that sort of issue in there, I think if you're going to have agriculture, my premise is that you're going to have agriculture. You can't have it as a third world agriculture, which means you've got nothing out there other than run-down towns, communities in small towns in dire circumstances. We know those exist there. To have a proper, healthy agricultural sector, you'll need healthy inland communities around them. Otherwise, you're not going to get the agricultural production. You're going to end up possibly with a skew. I can't think of it. It's not third world agricultural production, but a very very coarse production. So you need those communities there to sustain agriculture and the other things that come out of there as well. But I would argue there's also an argument trying to take pressure off our coastal communities, and Sydney in particular. I mean, you see Sydney drawing those people in, and towns like Orange are continuing to grow, often at the cost of outer communities, but they are growing as a whole. So I think there's a need for inland communities if we're going to continue to have economic production in inland Australia. My premise is that we're going to have ongoing economic production in inland Australia. Now, if you disagree with that, it would be a great debate.
I don't disagree with it. But we can fly in and fly out in the mining industry.
Yeah.
And if you look at some of the issues that the Parliament is dealing with in terms of over allocation of water, the Murray-Darling system, the long-term environmental costs of some of our agricultural pursuits, and the policy mix that actually sends positive signals to go to the city rather than go the other way, it just raises that policy issue about in terms of policy, are we actually encouraging inland Australia, or are we participating in its demise?
I think that, thank you for that clarification, as you said it in your first comment. I think the policy setting is very antithetical to inland Australia right now. That metro centricity issue, when they talk about decentralisation, it's often decentralisation not as far out as we would like it. And I give credit to New South Wales DPI, who moved their headquarters to Orange, so that they had a good crack at it. But you know, we talk about decentralisation, we don't actually do it in any significant way. And government has the capacity to do that perhaps greater than other organisations. Intriguingly, and this comes back to, which is not just agriculture, if you look at Albury Wodonga, there's a disproportionate number of accountants in Albury Wodonga, where the taxation officers, two of the major accounting firms have offices there, and a range of smaller providers. So there is a capacity to decentralise, and they are trying to attract people there for a range of reasons. So I think our policy settings in general are antithetical to inland Australia. Few have moved against it, but not in a sustained period over 25 years of trying to do these sorts of things. You're dead right. That's the settings that cause the metrocentricity that is so embedded in our thinking in Australia. You're dead right.
Well, we might draw this session to a close then, after a particularly profound question.
That was very
interesting way to finish it off. And I'd like you all to join me in thanking Ian for his presentation. And I thank you for your attendance.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming on. Appreciate it.
It's interesting how these